Welcome to the SDF conferencing system.
There are two other parties in this conference.
I don't know about other parties, but this is Publius, bringing you A Step Farther Out, the weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. So, what do we have to talk about today? Well, if you've been paying attention, you may notice that in the newspapers, you may have seen a headline something like, FAA approves Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic to carry paying passengers. That is wrong. This is an important distinction which may sound like one of these hyper-technical things, which is only interesting to people like me, but anybody you talk to in the industry will insist on it. Anybody you talk to at FAA, Office of Commercial Space Transportation, will insist on it, that there is a great difference, a difference with a serious legislative intent behind it, between passengers and personal spaceflight participants, which is a mouthful, but nobody's come up with a better word for it yet. I was at a conference where someone suggested human cargo, but I had to point out that that sounds more like slave ships than it does like something people do for entertainment. To be very clear, what the FAA, the distinction the FAA makes is that a passenger is someone who gets onto or into a conveyance expecting to be carried from one place to another. And if anything other than carriage from one place to another happens, if the person in question experiences anything other than mild discomfort and perhaps a slight delay, the law becomes very interested. A personal space flight participant, on the other hand, is treated a little more like a mountain climber. This is someone who gets into a conveyance and does so for the experience, not as a utilitarian tool which has relatively straightforward expectations connected with it. You don't get into a Spaceship II or a New Shepard without really understanding that this could end in death or grievous bodily harm, and assuming that that is not the result of gross negligence or malice on the part of the people who built and operated it, that's just considered to be a normal risk you take. That's between you and your insurance company, right? That's between you and, you know, MetLife, who flies around, you know, in his stupid blimp, right? And the FAA, Office of Commercial Space Transportation, OCST as it's known, works very closely with people who are trying to build spacecraft for personal space flight participants to participate in, to basically make sure that what they're doing seems reasonable, that there's nothing obviously bad about it, there's nothing wrong with it that a reasonable person wouldn't expect, but there is no expectation that you're going to necessarily come out of the experience unchanged. In fact, that's sort of why people do it, because you don't come out of the experience unchanged, and unfortunately, sometimes that change may result in a severed spinal cord. Normally, it's more about the, you know, having seen the world as a globe and experienced the sense of the fragility of life, which is protected under this thin shell of atmosphere. But sometimes it's less being, you know, mentally and spiritually changed and more physically changed into something resembling ground beef. Unfortunately, but that's the way it is. So, here in the coming months, according to present plans, both Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos are going to go up, again, into space by some definition of space. In other words, above 50 kilometers. They're not going into orbit. That takes about 10 times as much energy. But they're going up, and they're going to spend some time, say 10 to 15 continuous minutes, perhaps if they're lucky, 5 to 10 at least, in weightlessness. They're going to be above the sensible atmosphere. You know, there's no such thing as explosive decompression, by the way, but if the capsule were to be breached, they would suffocate long, you know, they would and desiccate and, you know, die rather unpleasantly because there's not the kind of atmosphere that you need to support life. In fact, the only thing atmosphere up that far is good for, basically, is making the lives of amateur radio operators more interesting. And the lives of people who want to operate communication satellites more difficult. Also, I guess it reduces, you know, catches some meteorites. But that's about it. Now, Richard Branson is a pretty wealthy man. Jeff Bezos is an extremely wealthy man. Now, I will say that I don't believe that massive concentrations of wealth are good for society. Now, what do I qualify as massive? So if you think about it briefly, if you had $5 million and were able to invest that at an annual return of 3%, you'd have an annual income of $150,000 a year, which is, in most places in the United States, more than enough to live comfortably on for one person, in many places enough for a family to live comfortably on. Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos each have more than 20 times that much wealth, at least nominally. Whether that's what that would turn into in real terms if they had to liquidate it is another story, but we're not going to get into that right now. The point is that when you're talking about those numbers, that is no longer a case of quality of life, right? Because you can have a comfortable life with $5 million of capital. 20,000 times that, aside from the fact that it means that there's a lot of people out there who don't have the opportunity to have anything at all, 20,000 times that basically means you have the opportunity to tell other people what to do, and they basically have to do what you want. And this is a double-edged sword, basically, because essentially any billionaire is a supervillain, period. He is somebody who tells people, you do what I say you should do, or I'm going to destroy your lives. Because that's what having immense wealth means. You can just buy and sell people. You can ruin people. Sometimes supervillains want to do stuff that's cool. I do think it's a bit concerning, though, when getting useful and interesting things done in our society depends on catching the interest of one of these people. That is the concern that I have. Essentially, that we are in a state of society now where, and you can see this in the Wall Street Journal. My grandmother gets the Wall Street Journal. And so I look at the Wall Street Journal and I think, these people honestly believe that what they're doing is the sane thing to do. These people honestly believe that what they're doing is what keeps society running. They genuinely believe that dollar valuations are more important than human life and happiness. Whereas, of course, I will always argue that the purpose of economic activity is to meet human needs. If you're doing something which shows a lot of dollar value, but that dollar value isn't reflected in increased human life and happiness, then something is badly wrong. That is my most, that is a very basic tenet for me. Now, Where does that lead me? Well, as you probably know, as you may know, as I surely haven't failed to tell you at some point, for, goodness gracious me, close to 15 years now, my efforts, my activities have been directed towards attempting to create, shall we say, a mass movement, if a small one. What is a small mass movement like? I don't know. But the idea being to get together people who are interested in doing what I consider to be some very important things. Namely, right, first and foremost, liberating humanity from the shackles of planetary existence, which starts with a human settlement on our nearest neighbor planet, the so-called satellite or moon, which really is more of a planet than it is a moon. Purely, as you will understand it, as a preparatory step towards what I would describe as the O'Neill future. If you've ever read The High Frontier by Jerry O'Neill, well, or Colonies in Space by T.A. Heppenheimer, there are other good books about this. From a purely capitalistic perspective, the three books, The Space Enterprise, The Third Industrial Revolution, and Space Power by G. Harry Stein. Stein here is definitely looking at things capitalistically, but his vision of capitalism is one in which we create wealth for the betterment of mankind. I've had people tell me, by the way, that the first trillionaire will be made in the space industry, to which my only thought is, my God, I hope not. We already have, I think, enough concentration of wealth. Now, a trillionaire is equivalent to 1,000 billionaires, right? Or 1 million millionaires. That kind of pyramiding can't be healthy. Now, why am I rambling on about this? Well, because I want to make the point, I think, that while I may be deeply dubious of Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, a whole bunch of, you know, lower-tier, very rich people like Bigelow and Branson, who are doing things that need to be done, doing things that are important to do. And if this is the only way we can get those things done, I'm willing to live with it. Don't expect me to be overjoyed. But these things are getting done, and that's important. Trouble is, of course, and this is one of the things that I worry about. It's very difficult to separate, right? It's the same whenever I saw the last administration in the United States advocating something that I'm personally for or that I think is good or important, my response was, oh, no. Because I knew that simply being associated with those people would unfortunately generate a lot of resistance to these things, would unfortunately discredit them by association. It's a serious problem. We see it right now where the United States House of Representatives, there is a strong faction of Democrats in the United States House of Representatives who are absolutely opposed to the current NASA moon landing program. Now, I'm not going to say that the NASA moon landing program that we have right now is the best possible thing, but constantly telling NASA to change directions every 2 years is a good part of the reason why they have such difficulty getting things done. And, this is important, any program like this would be better than none at all. See, this is the thing. The following statement is true. NASA has not put a human being on the moon in this century. The following statement is true. No human being has set foot on another planetary body in this century. The following statement is close to being true. It lacks only a few months of being true. 7 months of being true. no human being has set, I'm sorry, not seven, 18 months, thank goodness. No human being has set foot on another planetary body in the past half century. This is disturbing. Now, 10 here seems to be, in SDF.com, seems to be doubting a bit of my thesis. I would suggest reading The Servile State by Hilaire Belloc, which lays it out better than I can do, but think about this for a moment. In a capitalistic society, there are two groups of people. There are those who employ and those who are employed. There are those who buy labor and those who sell it. The people who sell labor do so because they do not have property which earns income. And so, in order to live, they must sell their labor. They must, period. They have no other choice. The people who buy labor, however, are free to buy labor or not to buy it, just as they please. And what this translates to in practice is that the people who buy labor, the people who own income-producing property, have the power to dictate to the people who sell labor exactly how they should live their lives, simply by saying, if you don't behave in the following manner, you're not going to be hired, and then you're going to be thrust out into the street to die of exposure and starvation. Tin asks, employing people equals evil? Well, fundamentally, yes. Because the function of an employer is not to give people work. The function of an employer is to say, you may not work unless you do as I say. Now, you may doubt this, but let me show you how this works. Let's take the Cornish tin mines as an example. Before the time of Henry VIII, the tin mines in Cornwall were considered a royal monopoly in Britain, which had this interesting characteristic that anyone who wished to enter into the tin mines and take up the business of mining tin was free to do so, could not be denied the right to mine tin, as long as he paid the portion which was due to the crown. Then in the time of Henry VIII, Henry, who wanted to, A, undermine other sources of legitimacy, such as the Cornish Stannary Parliaments, which were essentially self-organizing legislative bodies which governed the lives, democratic bodies which governed the lives of the tin miners. Henry VIII sold the monopoly to capitalists. He wanted a lot of money. Basically, he found some of his cronies who had money and were willing to pay him. And then what? Well, now these people had the right to tell miners, no, you may not go into the mines and mine unless you give us, unless you follow our requirements. And what their requirements were, essentially, was to work for a wage. So suddenly, instead of working for themselves, paying their own expenses, right, and the expenses of their households, and governing the amount of tin that they dug out by that, now these people are laborers. They are paid a wage. They have to pay their employers, right, who've put up a bunch of money in return for this. They want to get that money back. They also want as much other money as they could get out. So the miners have to work much harder, and they have a lower standard of living because they can't just go into the mine and dig out tin enough to pay their own expenses and sell it in the market. They have no choice. They will be kept out at gunpoint from the mine if they try to go in it in any other way than as laborers working for their employers. So, this is where we are at. Now, somebody's going to say, you're a communist, or Tin says, so if I'm wealthy, the only good moral option would be to shut up shop and not employ anyone? I don't see that. I feel, Tin, that you're being deliberately obtuse. But maybe I'm wrong. Okay. The thing is, what does your wealth consist in? Right? If you're wealthy, what does wealth consist in? What I want is a society in which there is more wealth and it is more widely distributed. Now, what does that end up looking like? You know, people talk about automation destroying jobs. Destroying jobs is not inherently a bad thing. Jobs. Who cares about jobs? As long as you have enough to eat, right? As long as you have a place to live, right? As long as you can afford to buy little luxuries, right? Why would you even want a job? You say, oh, well, it gives me something to do, so I'm not bored all the time. You must have a very little interior life. Because practically everyone I know, if they have their alimentation and lodgings taken care of, and a little bit of income so that they can buy little luxuries, or in my case, books that pile up around the place, right? Then they will find something. People are creative. People given leisure don't just vegetate, generally speaking, unless they've been told you're worthless without a job, unless they've been told work is the whole purpose of your life. You know, there's a lovely little book, it's really a compilation of lectures, by a German Catholic philosopher named Josef Pieper, Leisure, the Basis of Culture. I recommend that you read it and think about it. It's a very good thought. Tien says, are you going for the Austrian School of Economics angle here? Hell no! Those people are insane. No. This is very simple. If a factory is going to be closed, or if people are, if people are going to lose their jobs because of automation, let's suppose there are 1,000 people working at a widget factory, and then you're going to bring in machines which eliminate the need for 950 jobs. Well, let's say this. Let's divide the value of the factory into 1,000 shares and parcel it out to the 1,000 people, and then tell them, you know, you have gone from a 40-hour work week to a 2-hour work week. Everybody's got to keep coming in 2 hours a week because we've eliminated 19 out of 20 working hours. Now, here's a really interesting question. Are there any billionaires who made their money by doing the right thing, or is it only by some form of exploitation? This is a really interesting point, right? Because I am not going to say that all wealth, even all concentrations of wealth, is bad, but I have an interesting metric for that. So when Sir Henry Bessemer died, somebody, and it may have been Popular Mechanics, ran an article trying to answer this question, trying to say, did he deserve this money? Because he died he was very wealthy. Actually, I think this is when he retired, probably when he retired, and he was very, very wealthy. Now, how do you even evaluate that? How do you evaluate whether he deserved? So, Sir Henry Bessemer, he inherited some money, and he made a fortune, and then spent it all again. And he did this 2 or 3 times. Early on, he invented a new technique for gilding metal. In other words, putting a gold-like brass surface onto things like buttons. And each time he made a fortune, he took that large sum of wealth that he had, and he poured it into research and development, developing a new industrial process. And the last and greatest of these was the process for making steel. And so the measurement that was used, right, what these folks who evaluated the question, what they tried to say is this. Okay, in the last year before the Bessemer process for steelmaking was introduced to the market, which wasn't Sir Henry Bessemer's personal invention, you understand, but he was deeply involved with the development of it. In the last year before the Bessemer process was introduced to the market, there were so many tons of steel manufactured in the world, and this is the price that they sold for. And then they said, okay, so in every year since, we have steel statistics for this, in every year since, this is the amount of steel that's been made. So this is the total cumulative amount of steel which has been made in the world since the introduction of the Bessemer process. And these are the prices that that's sold for, so this is the total cumulative, this is the average price over that whole period for steel. Now, if we compare this to the price that would have had to be paid, at least theoretically. Basically, if you multiply the if you expand the volume of steel which was produced in the last year before the introduction of the Bessemer process to that whole cumulative amount that's been produced since, and then you look at that unit price it was sold for in that last year, then this, you know, then we compare the two sums of money, essentially. You know, if that amount of steel had been made, if it had been possible to make it, which of course it wasn't, but if it had been possible to make it by the old process, how much it would have cost versus what it cost, what it sold for under the new process. And then they looked at Sir Henry's personal wealth, and they said his personal wealth is less than 0.1% of this benefit to the world of the process that he introduced. And therefore, we think it's probably fair to say that he deserved that wealth. And I'm willing to go with that. Now, what else is there to say? Well, so I have here, you may have seen recently in the news that the administration in the U.S., the government, has slapped sanctions on imports of polysilicon from a manufacturer in Xinjiang, China, who is responsible for something like 50% of the world's supply. Now, this is an interesting thing for me. As you know, I'm a photovoltaic skeptic, but that's not the point here. The point is that in the 1970s, people got all excited about photovoltaics. But what they were talking about in terms of economics involved the fact that in those days, photovoltaics were made from offcuts, discards, and rejects from semiconductor chip production lines. Nowadays, however, the situation is quite different. Firstly, the amount of silicon per transistor for microchips and all that kind of thing has greatly decreased. You know, a 1N4001 diode has less than 10% the amount of silicon in it that it did in the 1970s. Even though it's labeled the same. And that does change its behavior slightly in regards to what, how much energy it can absorb before being destroyed and that kind of thing. But the point being that despite the enormously larger amount of semiconductor electronics being manufactured today than were manufactured in the 1970s, the total amount of silicon, the raw material that those semiconductor electronics consume, is not all that much larger. That's a consequence of what's called Moore's law, the increase in density of microchips. Now, on the other hand, photovoltaics have increased massively, due almost entirely to government encouragement, because they're not really all that useful in most circumstances, to the point that they now account for, what, 95-99% of all the semiconductor silicon manufactured in the world? So that's a very different picture economically and environmentally than it was when they were made in small batches using offcuts, rejects, and trimmings from the semiconductor production industry in Silicon Valley. And if you know anything about semiconductor silicon production, you know that it involves a lot of toxic waste and it involves a lot of energy, which is mostly being produced in China using coal without environmental controls, which I'm bound to say isn't good for humans and isn't good for the climate. And on top of that, this very large volume and the relatively low value of the product compared to, say, computer chips means a desire to get the material at the lowest possible price, meaning we're talking about quartzite mining with very little in the way of worker protections. And quartzite mining without worker protections is a death sentence. And now it looks like our government is finally acknowledging that a lot of that mining is being done by forced labor. So, congratulations on your PV panel. Yeah, you want to go green, but it's red with blood. Just a thought. Anyway, if you find these rantings and ravings of mine valuable to you, you can support me at paypal.me/PrometheusLives. I encourage you to check out the Man and Atom channel on tubenix.org for some very interesting instructional films. I've got a film on there. I have to pay to get films transferred, so any money that I get basically goes into stuff like this. A film about the recovery of natural gas using nuclear explosives is a favorite. Other than that, well, Tobe's Dubious Goals Committee is coming up in 5 seconds, And so stay tuned to anonradio.net for that show, which is at 19:30.
7, 6.